To the Ask Beatty Show, and I can hardly believe it, but today is the 250th Ask Beatty Show right here on the Progressive Radio Network. And as I was riding the subway from our apartment on the Upper West Side to the Progressive Radio Network studio, you know, I was asking myself the question, you know, what kind of impact have the 250 shows had on you? And since I rarely, if ever, have an opportunity to meet any of you, you know, I gladly welcome your phone calls. Of course, the live number is 888-874-4888. And as you probably all know, all of the shows on PRN, we have an archive section where you can actually go and listen to past shows. And I keep wondering and hoping that there is some little thing that I say every single week where you will have an aha moment that maybe in some small way, and hopefully in not just a small way, will help you change the quality of your life and the quality of your relationships. Because the Beatles, the lyrics are so very true, is that we go through life, and at some point for all of us, and no one is immune, including therapists, that life is just getting a little off track. And for some people, you feel you're on a roller coaster ride or on a merry-go-round, and not a fun merry-go-round that just doesn't seem to stop. And you don't really know what to do. And yet I think that many, many people, and perhaps most people, are still very, very reluctant to reach out and ask for help. And what I try to tell you, of course, every single week here on the Ask Beatty Show is that life is complex. It is stressful, and that we all need to give ourselves permission that we do not need to navigate this life on our own. So that I encourage you, if you are suffering from depression or anxiety or substance abuse, and the problems and the issues do not seem to improve, you've tried to exercise, you've taken vitamins, you meditate, and yet there are some things that are just continuing to get in the way of your life, that the very, very best thing that you actually can do is reach out and find yourself a really, really good therapist. Because, you know, when I researched the material for the Ask Beatty Show, sometimes the research findings are very, very startling. You know, for example, I don't know whether many of you would know that there are 350 million people worldwide, and how they got that number, I'm not exactly sure, you know, who are suffering from clinical depression. And in the United States, studies have shown that there are approximately 16 million adults who are dealing with, or perhaps not dealing sufficiently with, depression. And anxiety is now the number one mental health issue in the United States. And statistics tell us that there are over 40 million people who are suffering with an anxiety disorder. And I think that the real question, if you're going to be entering therapy, is that you have to hopefully find yourself a therapist who is not just going to be putting a bandage on your wounds, or simply say to you, should take a pill or take two or three pills and all of your problems are going to be resolved. And I think that if we're dealing with depression and anxiety in good therapy, certainly in the way that I do therapy, one really needs to begin at the beginning and try to understand and help the patient understand whether the issues are old issues. Was the abuse that went on in your family of origin, is that something that you are still carrying around inside of you, whether or not it was sexual abuse or physical abuse or verbal abuse or emotional emotional abuse? Or what about the fact that one or both of your parents had substance abuse issues and that you actually felt as a child that you were on a continual roller coaster ride? How are all of those things that happened oh so many, many years ago, are they still impacting your life today? Now, of course, the reality is that there's nothing that we can do to change the history. There's nothing that we can do to change something that happened 2 seconds ago. But what I have found, and I've been practicing psychotherapy and sex therapy now for over 35 years, that there is a way, and it's not going to happen in one session or in 45 minutes, but that there are ways to help people really emotionally work through the trauma, the pain, the depression, so that you have a clear understanding and you have a clear perspective of how your past and how your history is continuing to impact and to impact negatively on what is going on today and why it is so difficult for you to be able to engage in healthy relationships. And there is no shortcut, I believe, when it comes to trying to get to the root of the problem. And it would be very nice to say, well, the history doesn't matter and it is all about today. But unless the history is in a reasonably good place, people always, always live their lives with one foot in the past and one foot in the present, so that when you are interviewing therapists, it's very, very important to understand what their theoretical orientation is. Because if it's just a question of change your behavior and change your mind, and of course behaviors do need to change and our mindsets do need to change and oftentimes be modified, but that old stuff, that old unfinished business, those old skeletons in the closet do, fortunately or unfortunately, they need to be acknowledged and addressed and resolved as best as we can possibly do it. And what about, are you dealing with substance abuse? You know, you're drinking too much or you're just taking a variety of different over-the-counter medications and prescription medications. And you know why you're doing it. You're probably doing it because you're wanting to numb the pain, either pain from the past or pain from the present. And, you know, there was a really good article that I read on opiate addiction, and the article was talking about how there's such a strong correlation between opioid addiction and loneliness. And I think it's not just opioid addiction. I mean, people who drink too much and people who are popping too many pills, both prescription medications and over-the-counter medications, do you think that they're not trying to escape? And it's a lonely, lonely place to be living in our society today. Families are separated. I mean, they're separated geographically. There is more divorce that has gone on in the last number of years than ever before. And people are surprised. They're surprised to hear that the divorce rate for third marriages, yes, I said third marriages, is 72%. So families are breaking up in record numbers. And these days, so many people are no longer going into their offices where they can have face-to-face interaction with people. And I think it's great that you can do Facebook Live and you can be texting. And yet I think that what I'm seeing, certainly what I'm seeing in my practice here in New York City and in East Hampton, that people are feeling more and more and more alienated. So that's why it is so important that we give ourselves permission and that we take some action to try to interact with people as best as we possibly can. Otherwise, life becomes just too difficult to bear, certainly to bear on our own. And what about sexual problems? You know, I had an interview a couple of weeks ago with Kimberly Resnick-Anderson. In fact, I was on her podcast. It was taped over the weekend, and I'll let you know when it is going to be airing live. And we were discussing how sex is still a very, very difficult subject for I think most people to really talk about. And when things are not going well sexually, whether or not it's because of relationship issues or whether or not it's because of depression, or perhaps you're taking just too many prescription medications and over-the-counter medications that are really, really numbing you out sexually, or perhaps it's stress. And for so many men, and also women, there are hormone issues at play. And I talk about this a lot. I've treated a lot of men with erectile dysfunctions, or men and women who have very, very little sexual desire. And it's one thing to look at the depression or the anxiety or the mental health issues. It's another thing. And of course, it's very, very important to look at the relationships, because certainly for the majority of women, if we are not feeling good about our partners, if we're angry, if we're depressed, the last thing that the majority of women are going to want to do is jump into bed and have sex. So again, it's important to take a very, very hard look at all of the factors, at all of the issues that are getting in the way of our life, of our happiness. And, you know, talking again about erectile dysfunction, I've had men come into my office and they're having problems with erection. And, of course, the first thing that I'm going to ask them is whether or not they've had a good physical workup. And some will say yes. I think most will say no. And then I've asked them, well, have you had a testosterone test? Do you know what your testosterone levels are? And very, very frequently, the men will contact their doctors. And if they have had the test, the doctors routinely might say, yes, yeah, your levels are okay. And what I have learned over the years is that I want to know exactly what okay means. And frequently men will come back and their testosterone levels are very, very low. So it is not necessarily just one thing that is causing or that is contributing to your depression or your anxiety or your erectile dysfunction or your sexual problems or your substance abuse of various different kinds. And that is why it is so important to be working with somebody who is holistic, who is really willing and able to look at the totality of your life and of all of the various different factors that may be at play that are contributing to your unhappiness, that may be contributing to your relationship problems as well. And that's the thing, you know, when you're looking to find a therapist, I do not suggest that you go to the yellow pages. And these days, of course, you just go to the internet and you read reviews. I think it is so critical that you actually get a referral from somebody that you trust. And please do not be taken in by the splashy ads or the likes. And what I was really surprised to find out is that you can pay for followers. You can pay for all kinds of advertising that, of course, are things that are really not legitimate. And the other thing that we as consumers that we really need to do is that we need to make sure, if we've decided to make the really big decision, and it's not an easy decision to make, to be sure that your therapist that you choose specializes in your particular problem. Because not all doctors and not all therapists are experts in every single area. So you have a lot of questions as a consumer. This is your time. This is your money. This is your life. So people will ask me, you know, they'll call me on the phone for an initial consultation. And I let them know that I'm going to be asking a lot of really, really tough questions about your family background, your relationship history, your sex life, previous psychiatric problems, including possible hospitalizations or suicide attempts, and gestures and medications that you're going to be taking. This is very, very in-depth, my friends. Possible addictions and traumas, sexual abuse, sexual assault, affairs, and gender identity issues. And though I understand that many of these questions and subjects are going to be very, very difficult for you to really connect with and to answer, it is absolutely vital for the therapist to know these facts so that we will be able to figure out what is going on and come up with a viable treatment plan. And you need to know whether your potential therapist is on board with this process. And then you have to ask yourself after the first few sessions whether you are comfortable with your therapist. Now don't expect after your first session that you are going to feel, you know, a strong connection. It's not going to happen instantly, because like any relationship, it really takes time for trust to develop. However, if you continue to feel uncomfortable after several sessions, remember that this is not the only therapist in town with whom you will be able to connect with, and that there should never be, under any circumstances at all, inappropriate advances, sexual, verbal, or otherwise, that occurs between you and your therapist. And if you see that something is not kosher, it is not feeling right, then you need to give yourself permission to leave the relationship and that particular therapist. And another thing you need to ask yourself is whether or not your therapist is actually respecting your time and calling you back within 24 hours, including evenings and weekends if necessary. And then it comes to the question of how long should sessions be? Well, I live in New York City, and I would say that the average time that people tell me, you know, when they've seen other therapists, is that the sessions last about 45 to 50 minutes, which I find to be unconscionable, even though the insurance companies only pay for 50 to 60 minutes. And I was telling Kimberly Resnick-Anderson a little story when she was interviewing me on her podcast over the weekend, which, again, you are going to be hearing live in probably a week or so, is that there was a game changer for me that occurred probably 25 years ago. I was waiting in my office. I had a private practice in Providence, and I was waiting to see a couple for the first time, and they had just driven in from Newport, Rhode Island, and they were late, and they were very apologetic. And they said, "Beatty, we've spent over an hour driving to your office in Providence. Do you do long sessions?" And at that time, I said, "No, my sessions are 60 minutes, an hour is 60 minutes, and that's what I do." And they said, "Would you be willing, since we spent, you know, over an hour in the car, you know, driving to see you?" And on that particular day, it absolutely changed the way I practice psychotherapy. And it is not unusual at all for me. And this is something, of course, that I discuss with my patients before they come in for their initial meeting. It is not unusual at all for me to spend many, many consecutive hours. I remember with one man, we actually spent 6 hours. It was the first time that I'd met him. He had come in from California, and it was amazing. The time went by very, very quickly, and what was even more importantly, I was really able to get a very, very clear, in-depth picture of what was going on, of what the issues were that needed to be acknowledged, addressed, and resolved. Now, these long, long sessions, of course, are not for everybody, but it really does. It's amazing. It really does fast forward the process, and it actually shortens the overall amount of time that people are in therapy, so that if you don't like your 45 or 50 minute sessions, at least you can have a conversation with your therapist and see whether or not he or she would be willing to have a much, much more intensive and extensive experience. Now, something else that's really important, and I don't know how many therapists actually do this. This is the way I was trained, and I thank goodness every day for my terrific training, my graduate and my postgraduate training at McGill University in Montreal. Sometimes it is really important for the therapist to have contact with your primary care doctor. And this is necessary in order to rule out any physical problems or prescription medications that may be contributing or causing your problems like depression or anxiety. And after a few sessions, your therapist should be able to tell you exactly what is going on and give you a very detailed treatment plan. And I also believe that, at least in the beginning, that anything less than weekly sessions is not going to enable you to have the best possible momentum in order to achieve success in your therapy. Now, this is another bone of contention that I think a lot of people in my field have, a lot of therapists have, and that is the question of whether or not you should ask your spouse or your parent or your siblings or your children to participate in the therapy. Now, this is my perspective on all of this, is that if there are family issues, if there are couple issues, how can we not, as responsible therapists, have the people who you are living with, who you are interacting with, who you are having difficulties with, not participate? There are certainly a lot of reasons and viable reasons for people to enter into individual therapy, but family problems require a family systems orientation. Couple problems require that two people are going to be engaged in a couple's therapeutic process, which does not mean that the couple cannot also have their own individual therapist. And these are things that are very, very important for you, the consumer, to understand. Otherwise, you may inadvertently be getting very, very short-changed in your therapy. And then I think what's also important is that you need to, and you and your therapist need to be doing some ongoing evaluation in order to determine how well or how badly your therapy is going and how well or how badly you are feeling. Now, you have to expect that at times you are going to feel pain. You are not going to feel like you are going to a restaurant for a lot of fun and having a conversation with a friend, because a lot of deep introspection, it is definitely, definitely going to make you feel sad. Because if there were a lot of sad things that happened in your life, what would be the appropriate emotion to sad things? Obviously, you are going to be feeling sad. You are going to be feeling anxious. So don't expect that after every single session, you are going to walk out and you are going to be feeling great. And you're going to have some homework to do yourself after you leave. It's not just about having an hour or a couple of hours with the therapist, but figuring out for yourself and really monitoring yourself whether or not the things that you are learning in therapy are things that you are actually implementing in your life. And I give my patients homework every single time just before they are going to be leaving, regardless of of what the issues are. And I ask them to consider two things. One is that when they are navigating their lives and when they are going through their day-to-day activities, I want them to be very mindful of what they are doing in terms of whether or not their behaviors and their activities and their interactions are in their best interest, and that includes eating well and not eating sugars and being very mindful of one's diet, but also being very, very mindful of interactions with colleagues, with friends, with relatives, with partners, to be making sure that we are doing things that are good for us versus things that are destructive and self-destructive, so that there's a lot of homework. There are a lot of things that people have to do when they are working with me. The question of medication, frequently comes up, especially if people have been suffering for depression or for anxiety for a long, long period of time. And although no one likes to go on medication, there are certain clinical situations, in my professional opinion, that absolutely require a combination of medication and psychotherapy. And I'm going to read you actually a recent study from The Guardian, that's in London, about antidepressants. So listen, don't beat yourself up. If you have found, or if you find, that massage and acupuncture and energy healing and meditation and vitamins and exercise and eating healthily have not helped you to alleviate your symptoms, okay, don't beat yourself up. If you find that there may be a need for some psychopharmacology that's going to be added to your psychotherapy. In fact, I really do want to read you some of the results from this Guardian study. And the headline was, "The Drugs Do Work. Antidepressants Are Effective Studies Show." Now, some people are absolutely antidepressants and anti-anxieties medications at all costs. And yet I have a couple of patients right now in my practice, and they had no desire years and years ago to go on any kind of medication. And yet they've told me that without their small, low doses of antidepressant and anti-anxiety medication, that they have told me in their experience, and this is their experience, we cannot pretend to know everything about what is going on and what is best for every single person. I mean, hopefully we figure out what's going to be, you know, best for us, but we cannot assume to know what is best for everybody that we treat. So the headline goes on to say that doctors hope, this was a 2018 study, that doctors hope that the study will put to rest doubts about the medicine and help to address global under-treatment of depression. And it says it's official, antidepressants are not snake oil or a conspiracy. And I know that Gary Null has a lot of feelings about this. And I know that there are many, many people in the world of alternative health who would debate this. And I am a very bottom line therapist. I want to prescribe for my patients, of course, even though I don't prescribe medication, whatever it is that is going to actually work, that is going to help people be the best they can be so that they can live their lives in the most joyful ways possible. So this is what the study says. According to this study, antidepressants work, some more effectively than others, in treating depression. According to authors of a groundbreaking study, which doctors hope will finally put to rest doubts about the controversial medicine. Millions more people around the world should be prescribed pills or offered talking therapies which work equally well for moderate to severe depression, say the doctors, noting that just one in six people receive proper treatment in the rich world and one in 27 in the developing world. Depression is the single largest contributor to global disability that we have. It's a massive challenge for humankind, says John Geddes, professor of epidemiological psychiatry at Oxford University, and it affects around 350 million people worldwide, and instances rose almost 20%. That's interesting, since 2005 through 2015. He goes on to say that antidepressants are an effective tool for depression and that untreated depression is a huge problem because of the burden to society, of course, also to the burden of the individual who was suffering from the anxiety. And this particular study published in The Lancet took 6 years and included all the published and unpublished data that the scientists could find. It was carried out by a team of international experts. They looked at results after 8 weeks of more than 500 trials involving either a drug versus placebo or comparing two different medicines. The most famous antidepressant of them all, Prozac, now out of patent and known by its generic name of fluoxetine, was one of the least effective but best tolerated, measured by a low dropout rate in the trials or fewer side effects reported. So again, I think that we have to be very, very open to a variety of possible treatments, whether or not we're talking about depression, whether or not we're talking about anxiety, or whether or not we're talking about physical or health problems as well. And let us not box ourselves in with the possible consequence of really being self-destructive and destructive to ourselves. But this was also an interesting article that I found. It identifies six conditions, and I think that this is something so important that we need to be discussing with our primary care doctors. So here are six conditions that feel like clinical depression, but they are not. So if a person went to his primary care physician, and of course, if the appointment lasted for more than 10 or 15 minutes and complained of symptoms. So just think about this. You're feeling fatigue, guilt, worthlessness, irritability, insomnia, decreased appetite, loss of interest in regular activities, persistent sadness, anxiety, and thoughts of suicide. I am pretty sure my doctor, Dr. Baskin, is not like that. He would take blood tests. He would give me a complete physical. But I think that most doctors, or at least many doctors, would prescribe an antidepressant for those kinds of symptoms that appear to be a major depression disorder. However, and I want you to really take this in, because sometimes symptoms that we may have, physical symptoms, emotional symptoms, psychiatric symptoms, they may look like they are physical or psychiatric, but they may be something else, and they may be combination, which is why when we're choosing physicians and when we're choosing therapists, that we have to be with people who are willing to take the time, who have the knowledge, who have the expertise, who have the patience to help you, to help all of us really get to the root of the problem. So going on with this article, it says that those same symptoms belong to a variety of other conditions that require treatments other than antidepressants and psychotherapy. And they list the six, and I think that they're really interesting. Number one, vitamin D deficiency. So a good doctor will order blood work to see if a patient is low on vitamin D before sending him or her off with a prescription for Prozac or some other kind of antidepressant, because so many of us are lacking adequate amounts of this critical vitamin. And in fact, according to a 2009 study published in the Archives of Internal Medicine, as many as 3/4 of U.S. teens and adults are deficient, and no wonder we are exhibiting all of these signs and symptoms that look like depression. And last year, Canadian research performed a systematic review and analysis of 14 studies that revealed a close association between vitamin D levels and depression. And these researchers found that low levels of vitamin D corresponded to depression and increased odds for depression. So if you're feeling depressed, you may want to go to your family doctor and get your vitamin D levels. In fact, have a really, really complete blood work. Another condition that looks like depression but may not be is hypothyroidism. Another easily mistaken condition for clinical depression is hypothyroidism, and you feel exhausted and worthless and irritable and incapable of making a decision, and getting through each day without naps is a major accomplishment. I hear this a lot in my practice. In fact, I'm seeing somebody right now. Her life is going so well. She's got a great job. She has a new boyfriend. And this is what she was saying to me last week in our therapy session. She can't make a decision, and she cannot seem to find a way to get out of bed. And I said to her, I said, listen, you need a physical workup. It would have been very easy to say, okay, you need to go and see a psychiatrist, or you need to go and find somebody who's going to prescribe an antidepressant. So that is something that is really important. And apparently, this underactive thyroid happens to be one of the most undiagnosed, misdiagnosed, and unrecognized health problem in the world. So again, don't assume, check it out. Also, low blood sugar. The best marriage advice that I ever received was this, according to this author: when you are about to say something unkind to your spouse, first check to see if you're angry. Jim, honey, I can totally relate to this. I know that if I'm feeling dehydrated or if I'm feeling hungry, it is not unusual for me to start to behave in a way that's less than loving. So I have to remind myself of this and either drink some more water or munch on a piece of fruit so that my mood is going to remain level and kind and loving. So naturopathic doctor, his name is Peter Bongiorno, he explains the mood-blood sugar connection in his informative post. Is there a sugar monster lurking within you? What a great blog name. Hunger, he says, is a primitive signal known to set off the stress response. And for people who are predisposed to anxiety and depression, that stress manifests itself as mood changes. And he goes on to say that triggered by drops and fluctuations in blood sugar, anxiety and depression can manifest in people who are very sensitive and can become chronic if food intake isn't consistent. So again, these are things that we have to remind ourselves of, whether or not we're talking about vitamin D deficiency or whether we're talking about an active thyroid or low blood sugar, and also dehydration. And according to two studies conducted at the University of Connecticut's Human Performance Laboratory, even mild dehydration can alter a person's mood. So again, we have to make sure that we are drinking plenty, plenty of water. And also in this article, they talk about food intolerances. And a Dr. Mark Hyman was saying that certain foods can trigger inflammation in our bodies, just like toxins from the environment. And while some people will break out in hives, other folks tend to get sad and anxious and start making plans to exit this earth. So talk about the importance of the mind-body connection. And when we are choosing therapists and when we are choosing family practice doctors, we need to make sure that the two orientations, that the two philosophies are in sync with one another, because none of these things are mutually exclusive. And then I thought this was really interesting. The author is talking about caffeine withdrawal. And he says, I'll always remember my sister's advice last summer when I showed up to her Michigan farm shaking, crying, and unable to focus on a conversation. I was in the midst of a severe depressive episode. One morning was especially bad. I tried to bring my coffee cups to my lips, but my hands were quivering so much, even that was difficult, says the author. Then, he says, I read Caffeine Blues by Stephen Chernicki, who has certainly done his homework on the matter and offers a compelling case for quitting America's number one drug for good. It's basic physics, really. What goes up must come down. So that high you get after a shot of espresso is not without its consequences. You just don't associate the anxiety and depression you feel 3 hours later because you're on to other things. However, your body is going through withdrawal. And for those of us, like my sister, he says, and me, who are chemically sensitive to all amphetamine-like substances that raise dopamine levels, that withdrawal translates to tears, shaking, panic attacks, and other forms of suffering. And I think that this is really, really interesting and important information. I think that most of us really don't know about. And I think that many, many doctors, they either don't know about it, don't think about it, don't take the time to really research what possible things, are involved and are impacting your mood, your depression, your anxiety. And you know, when I talk about all of this again, the modern mental health, the modern psychiatry prescribes a pill for every mental ill problem without treating the underlying causes of what ails us. And that is a problem. So again, it is getting to the root of the problem, whether or not we're talking about dealing with unfinished business from your family of origin, or unfinished business from your sexual assault or your early child sexual abuse. And this is what comprehensive medical care, and this is what comprehensive psychotherapy is really, really all about. And this was a piece in the New York Times that I thought was a little depressing, but I think it was a very honest piece. The effectiveness of talk therapy is overstated, and I still believe it's because of the methodology that people use. So here we have medical literature has overstated. This was a piece by Benedict Carey, New York Times. Medical literature has overstated the benefits of talk therapy for depression in part because studies with poor results have rarely made it into journals. Their analysis is the first effort to account for unpublished tests of such therapies. Treatments like cognitive behavioral therapy and interpersonal therapy are indeed effective, the analysis found, but about 25% less so than previously thought. And he goes on to say, 5 million to 6 million Americans receive psychotherapy for depression each year, and many of them are also taking antidepressant drugs. And most people find some relief by simply consulting a doctor regularly about the problem and engaging in a course of well-tested psychotherapy according to the new analysis gives them an added 20% chance of achieving an even more satisfying improvement or lasting recovery. Before accounting for the unpublished research, that figure was closer to 30%, a difference that suggests that hundreds of thousands of patients are less likely to benefit. So we have to be very, very careful when we are looking at studies, and we are finding more and more how the results of studies can easily be manipulated. And in some of the other statistics that I have found in looking at the effectiveness of therapy, 5 to 10% of people get worse. Be interesting to find out why that is. 35 to 40% of people experience no benefit. And again, I think it depends on the kind of therapy that is being done. And then if you are only putting bandages on the wounds, I think that that would explain the 35 to 40% experience of no benefit. And overall, in looking at all of this, that the failure rate of psychotherapy is 50%. Of course, you could also say that the success rate of psychotherapy is 50%. So interesting. Again, you know, for those of you who've been contemplating, you know, getting therapy for yourself, I think it's important. I think it's really important to do your homework, to find out, to do a little bit of reading about depression or anxiety, or if you're suffering from undiagnosed bipolar disorder, and then to do a lot of homework when you are choosing who you are going to be working with. It can make all the difference in the world. And every week, I like to remind you all of the things that we know. These are not things that are unknowns, but things that we know that actually do help you improve the quality of your life and the quality of your relationships. And we have to look at diet. I mean, Gary Null, he talks about this every single day, how important it is for us to be on a plant-based diet. All the studies show this. We can make all the excuses in the world for not doing this, but people who live the longest, people who are the healthiest, have decided that they are going to listen to the research. There is just so much research that supports this, and that they are going to change their diets from hamburgers and hot dogs and donuts to plant-based diets. People also, again, research supports all of this. They interact with others. They socialize and they sleep 8 hours a night. And they nap every day if they are so lucky that they are able to take the time and nap. They also exercise. And there are so many reasons, especially in the winter, especially in the cold. We can make 1,000 different excuses why we can't exercise. And it's too cold and we don't have the time and we're too tired. And yet exercise, exercise, exercise can make all the difference in terms of how we feel, our mood. It's a great antidepressant. It's a great anti-anxiety. And it's something, whether or not you're interested in weight training, I was on the treadmill a couple of days ago. I was feeling a little down. It was cold. I was complaining about the weather. And I said to myself, enough already. I need to get to the club and I need to get on the treadmill. And it was wonderful. I ran for about a mile at a pretty good speed. And afterwards, that feeling, the anxious feelings, it was just amazing. It almost completely dissipated within just 15, 20 minutes of running. So again, these are things that we know that are actually things that are in our best interest. So it's easy to make excuses, but today is a new day, and hopefully you are going to incorporate some of these ideas, if not all of these ideas, into your daily routine. So the plant-based diets, the sleep, the exercise, having supportive people in your life, and eliminating any and all toxins, including toxic people. So again, you have to be honest with yourself. You have to be mindful of whether or not you are doing things that are really good for you, that are really in your best interest, or whether you are engaging in life on a day-to-day basis in things that are destructive and self-destructive, and then you're wondering why you're not feeling well, why your relationships are not going well. So mindfulness in that sense is so, so very important. And it's also important to have positive visualizations. You know, we can think about all the terrible things that are going on in our life, but positive visualizations, dancing, listening to music, affirmations, herbal teas, essential oils, massage, acupuncture, slowing down, de-stressing, journaling as a way to be able to express your inner feelings, express your inner thoughts so that you are not keeping things buried inside. And of course, now that it's spring and living in New York City, it seems as if every other person has a dog, certainly in our area on the Upper West Side. And not only is having a dog, you know, wonderful for one's psyche, for one's emotions, it gets us going, but the interactions that occur on a daily basis, and of course with us, with Cha-Cha, we walk her 3 times a day, or we should be walking her 3 times a day for more than just a couple of minutes. The interesting people, the interesting interactions that the dogs have with one another, that the people have, that the owners have with one another, it can really make, again, it can make your days so, so much brighter. So again, we know that there are many, many positive and empowering and terrific things that we can do for ourselves every day. And I do. I want you to monitor. I want you to monitor every day whether or not you are incorporating a lot of these things. And I promise you, I do, that if you do, you are really going to start to feel so much better about yourself, about the quality of your life, about the quality of your relationships. And if you need a little bit of help, if you need a little bit of coaching, if you need a little bit of therapy to help you get back on track or to get yourself and to find yourself on a new and better track, please do give yourself permission to do it. It is not a weakness. It is a strength. Professional athletes, performers, we all have mentors. We all have people who can give us some tips. You know, in the olden days, we had our elders who could talk about what happened 50 years ago and 70 years ago. And, of course, these days, you know, people are strewn all over the country and all over the world. And I think that it is just so important that we learn from others who've gone through the experiences where we can teach ourselves better ways to be able to navigate our lives. And I think that all of this, if we incorporate even a small part of all of this, we are going to see some major, major differences in how we feel every single day. And, you know, again, I'm hoping that there's something that I've said today, that there's something that I've said during the past 250 Ask Petey shows that have really impacted you in some way, that have perhaps motivated and inspired you to look at your life, to look at your problems, to look at your relationships in a different way, so that you are going to be able to live a happier and a more contented life. I think it's so easy to just spend our time feeling stressed. And there was an article that I wanted to talk about that I'm going to talk about next week on how workaholism has become an aspirational lifestyle for so many people. And I think that we're missing the boat, because it really is about balance. It really is about love. It really is about healthy relationships. So I think for most of us, we have some work to do. And as I say to patients and prospective patients, you know, if you're serious, if you're actually serious about making some changes in your life, life can be really very beautiful and very fulfilling, and you can live the life that you would hope to live. But in the final analysis, it's up to you. And are you prepared to take certain kinds of actions?